When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover on the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We currently have a bonus episode about True Detective Night Country with reactions to Dune Part 2 and the new FX miniseries Shogun soon to follow. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
You believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Genevieve Kosky
and Scott Tobias.
Tasha Robinson remains away and unaccounted for, though we've heard rumors about a crime spree in the American Southwest that sounds suspiciously like her work. We'll keep you posted on that. So for these episodes, it's just the three of us hanging out, watching the sunset, and talking about the future, slash a couple of movies that we thought had some elements and maybe some creative talent in common.
It's the salad days for us right now, isn't it?
It is the salad days. That is, you know, and all our seeds not falling on barren soil or whatever. If you haven't seen Raising Arizona, that's going to sound really out of context. Genevieve, speaking of Raising Arizona, did I give it away too quickly? tell us about the next two films we'll be discussing on the next couple of episodes.
Sure. The new Driveaway Dolls is the first narrative feature for which Ethan Coen has taken a solo directing credit, though that's actually a little misleading. The script is by Coen and wife Trisha Cook, who effectively served as his co-director, per interviews with the couple. The project has been kicking around almost since the year in which the film is set, 1999, when a pair of Philadelphia women, played by Geraldine Viswanathan and Margaret Qualley, find themselves on the run from some violent criminals after accidentally agreeing to drive a car with valuable cargo to Tallahassee. Its madcap escapades put us in mind of another Ethan Coen collaboration, the 1987 film Raising Arizona. The second feature Ethan made with his brother Joel, Raising Arizona stars Nicolas Cage as small-time criminal H.I. McDonough and Holly Hunter as his wife Ed, a police officer who falls for him over the course of repeatedly booking him into jail. When they discover Ed cannot bear children, the pair decide to take one from a wealthy couple that's recently become parents to quintuplets.
So this week we'll head to the desert, a place where the Huggies are a precious commodity and post-apocalyptic bikers freely roam the freeways to talk about Raising Arizona. Then in the next episode, we'll take a sex and violence heavy trip down the eastern seaboard with the Driveaway Dolls.
Turn to the right!
The first time I met Ed was in the county lockup in Tempe, Arizona.
You're a flower, you are.
A day I'll never forget.
I do.
You bet I do.
Okay, then.
My lawless years were behind me. Our child-rearing years lay ahead. But biology conspired to keep us childless.
You go right back up there and get me a toddler. I need a baby hide. I got more than I can handle.
At the time, Ed's little plan seemed like the solution to all our problems. And the answer to all our prayers.
He's beautiful.
What? Are you kidding? We got us a family here.
I want Nathan Jr. back.
What's his name?
Ed Jr.
Hi, Jr.
So far, we've just been using Jr.
We call him Jr.
In a 1987 profile that ran in Rolling Stone, Joel and Ethan Coen talk about how they structured their screenplays, which essentially involved not structuring them at all. Quote, the Coens write scripts without an outline, painting themselves in and out of corners, unquote. That's what David Handelman wrote after spending some time in the company of the Coens as they spitballed and chain-smoked. It's the sort of approach that might, for instance, produce a screenplay in which the opening credits arrive 11 minutes into the film, on the heels of an only occasionally interrupted voiceover monologue. It's also the sort of approach that freely picks up themes and ideas as it rolls along. A comedy about a hapless stick-up man who never loads his gun could turn into an unlikely romance while perhaps reflecting the era of its creation. For instance, here's a quote. "I tried to stand up and fly straight, but it wasn't easy with that sumbitch Reagan in the White House." That's protagonist H.I. McDonough in the film's opening sequence. Then H.I., hi to his friends, being an inherently sweet guy, adds, "They say he's a decent man, so maybe his advisors are confused." That's the last explicit reference Raising Arizona makes to the 40th president, unless the Mondale Ferraro bumper sticker counts. But 80s inequality is baked into the design of Raising Arizona. Ed and Hi are a pair of have-nots, and they're tired of watching those who have more than they need. Specifically, they want a baby, but can't have one of their own. So when local furniture tycoons Nathan and Florence Arizona, played by Trey Wilson and Lynn Cate, describe their recently arrived quintuplets as more than they can handle, a light bulb goes off. Why not spread the wealth around? Would that it were so simple. Ed and Hi learn that kidnapping one of the Arizona babies, Nathan Jr. to be precise, arguably the best one, is one thing. But keeping that baby is another matter. Beyond the ballooning cost of diapers, Jr. inspires envy in everyone around them. These include Hi's boss, Glenn, played by Sam McMurray, and Glenn's wife, Dot, played by Frances McDormand. They have a handful of ill-behaved children of their own, but feel they could use one more because theirs have grown too big to cuddle. Even Hi's escaped prison buddies, Gail, played by John Goodman, and Avelle, played by William Forsythe, can't resist Junior's charms. The film's Arizona setting is a gun-filled land in which those that have go to extremes to keep it from those who don't, and getting ahead means taking part in the system that rewards cheating. But, as with every Coen Brothers movie, to latch onto one aspect is to risk overlooking everything else that's going on. Doing a wild 180 from their neo-noir debut, Blood Simple, Raising Arizona is a comedy, one filled with oddball characters who've adopted peculiar speaking styles that reveal a fondness for the flexibility of the English language. With the help of cinematographer Barry Sonnenfeld, the camera becomes an active participant in some wild physical comedy set pieces. Raising Arizona draws on everything from Preston Sturges movies to Warner Brothers cartoons to The Road Warrior, but they all somehow make sense together. Synthesizing seemingly disparate elements has been one of the Coens' great strengths from the beginning. Another strength is heart. Though they have sometimes been called cerebral and cold, the Coens' films almost always have an emotional undercurrent that, in key moments, can sweep you away. Think of Marge talking about A Beautiful Day in Fargo, or Sheriff Bell recalling A Pair of Dreams in No Country for Old Men. Or think about High's own memory of a dream about a place, quote, "where all parents are strong and wise and capable, and all children are happy and beloved," end quote. It's in that moment it becomes clear that beneath the political commentary, memorable turns of stage, and slapstick, Raising Arizona is a film about two lonely people who find they love one another and want to share that love. The world they live in may not be hospitable to their dreams, but maybe someday they'll find themselves in a better sort of world.
What's that smell?
We don't always smell this way, Ms. McDonough. I was just explaining to your better half here that when we were tunneling out, we happened to hit the main sewer line. Dumb luck, that. And we followed that
you
to...
You mean you busted out of jail?
No, ma'am. We released ourselves on our own recognizance.
What Evel here is trying to say is that we felt the institution no longer had anything to offer us. My Lord, he's cute.
He's a little outlaw. You can see that high.
Now, listen, you folks can't stay here.
Raising Arizona draws on many styles and influences that should not really work together. Why do you think they do? Unless you disagree.
Do they, Keith? I guess they kind of do.
Sure.
I will say Raising Arizona was one of the few films of theirs that took me a little bit of time to embrace. I did not go the Roger Ebert route. I think he was like a 1.5-star type review of this film. And I don't think I was quite on board with the usual sort of tongue cluckers with the Coens, who are talking about how they, you know, the look down on their characters and they're smug and cold and all this other stuff. Or maybe I wasn't. Maybe I was someone on board with it. But I think as you look at the entire body of work and as more Coen films come out, I think you kind of appreciate the fluidity with which they're able to combine these styles and influences, that these are two filmmakers who are really steeped in film and literature, in Americana, and kind of are able to kind of mix and match all of those elements without it ever feeling like you're getting jerked around too much. The film feels very assured and coherent from the very beginning. It all ties together like the rug in The Big Lebowski.
So this was the first Coen Brothers movie I saw. I saw it in the theater. You know, I was junior high, so I was not particularly old, but I'd read good reviews of this, perhaps not Ebert's, but our local critic, Terry Lawson, was really into it and other good reviews. And I sought it out because it looks like something I would enjoy. This is kind of like my first Coen Brothers movie. If you know, I have a real affection for it for that reason. But what made you a little slow to get on board, Scott?
You know, I mean, maybe it was just kind of thinking it was a little bit on the glib side, but I'm really not sure why, you know, I mean, you think about those first like four, say, features of the Coens, you've got, you know, Blood Simple and Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink, and then this one. And I, those others, I just adored in a way that I just never did for Raising Arizona until pretty recently. And I'm really not sure why, because watching it I watched it both for this podcast and then really just a month ago on a family movie night and had a great time with it.
What about you, Genevieve? What are your feelings about this movie?
I also came to it like fairly late in my Coen Brothers education. You know, I was a child when it came out, so it was one that I had to like, you know, seek out to see for the first time. By that point, I think sort of the comedy side of the Coen Brothers was so entrenched in my mind alongside The Big Lebowski, which was my first Coens.
Wow.
Actually, I think Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was maybe my first theatrical Coens, and then quickly followed by Big Lebowski. So like that is sort of the comedic Coens mode I was familiar with. And Raising Arizona is not in the same vein, but it's much more madcap and audacious and fast. You know, like one of the things about Lebowski is it's just a kind of a very ambling movie compared to this one's like pretty manic, stylized energy and slapstick elements. So I think it's easy on first watch, I think, to maybe not quite grok the sweetness, I guess, at the heart of this film. Not even the sweetness, sort of the deeper, like, existential meaning at the heart of this film and, you know, ideas about the American dream and nuclear family. And, you know, if we're all caught in a perpetual destructive cycle of our own making, you know, these sort of philosophical ideas are maybe not quite as present on the surface here as they are in Lebowski or even Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, you know, that has a protagonist who spouts those ideas very openly. But I think Raising Arizona is one that is among the most rewarding on rewatch. I think this is maybe my third time with it. And it was on this watch, I was like, I really wish I had seen this movie like three more times before discussing it, because there's like so many little elements here that I want to kind of revisit a little more deeply. And you know, unfortunately, we didn't have a lot of time before recording this podcast, or I probably would have rewatched it again for this, because I think that there is a lot here, especially in the character of High and sort of the implication that he is raising these other characters from hell or wherever, you know, sort of these embodiments of his criminal side that are kind of pursuing him through this story. And like I said, this sort of like existential thread that runs through this movie. I want to be able to examine it more deeply than I fear I'm going to be able to on this podcast. But maybe one of you has some brilliant insight about that element of the film to illuminate.
I think that was such a good start, Genevieve. That's a That's a pretty good observation.
Well, thank you. Now, tell me more, though. Or not. Maybe, I mean, I guess that's kind of maybe the strength or the appeal of the film is like, it doesn't, you know, it's not didactic in any of these ideas, you know, and it exists in this sort of like magical realism space where like these embodiments, they are real and they do interact with the real world. But the film doesn't necessarily come down on one interpretation of them over the other. So I think you can experience it on a real quote unquote surface level and enjoy the sort of madcap caper chase energy, or you can dig into that mud that Gale and Evel emerge from like hell demons, you know, and what it all means. So I don't know. Is that is that a level that either of you engage with this film?
That's really good. And like also like could talk about the circularity of it, the beginning of it, where he just kind of keeps going through the same cycle, and it's about trying to break that cycle. But once he does, he finds himself into sort of a different hellish cycle where work is just like prison, except maybe you get a paycheck at the end of it, you know. But you have to listen to Emmett Walsh drone on about some sort of horrible anecdote that you never want to hear.
You know? Uncle Sam takes a bite, don't she? That's a line that I always keep in mind. You know, it's funny. I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit here, but since this little brief breakup sort of between the Coen brothers, where you have The Tragedy of Macbeth and then Driveway Dolls, all of these kind of like rumors about like who brings what to the table in terms of what kind of like comic energy versus this more philosophical, you know, sort of darker energy. Those two films go to those extremes, and mm-hmm. Raising Arizona is a movie that feels like an Ethan movie, but that's sneakily a Joel movie. You know, it's like there, as Genevieve was saying, like you can just, you know, I think when you first see Raising Arizona and when you see it again and again, like you can like the surface pleasures of it, the dialogue, the fun use of language, and you know, certain turns of phrase and kind of cartoonish characters, the really aggressive style of it can make you feel like that it is kind of a lark, really. And it's all of these other elements of it that just sort of that seem subtler, kind of in a way that they're sort of you know, slip in there and can maybe get you to think a little deeper about this film down the line. It's sort of a way homer in that respect. So I appreciate that balance, you know. And there was
why they call it a way homer?
Because you get on the way home, right? Something like that. But
But Scott, I am home.
Oh, man. You got to get a dip tet. I'm just going to quote dialogues from this film. But
I think the dialogue in a lot of places also kind of speaks to this. I don't want to quite call it like a high-low dichotomy, mm-hmm. but this, sure, we'll call it a high-low dichotomy. And that, like, you know, these characters, especially high and especially in voiceover, is prone to some highfalutin language that we hear less in, like, these characters actually conversing, you know? Like, and I don't know if we like just want to jump into like talking about the voiceover more generally, but you know, it strikes me as coming from a different version of High, maybe like the future version of High that he dreams of at the end, and you know, that would, you know, bring everything nicely full circle. But I digress. These Coen characters always kind of have a way of, you know, with highfalutin language undercut by just kind of rank stupidity,
right.
you know, and sort of that's, I think that could be read potentially as glib as you characterized it before, Scott. But I also just think it's like, it's such a Coen's signature, you know, like the idea that these characters are not necessarily as these people would exist in the real world, but they're kind of expressions of all of the influences, you know, that are personified in these characters.
I think that this high-low thing could be kind of unexpected with the characters. I think, you know, William Forsythe's character, you know, can say a line about how we released ourselves on our own recognizance, but I don't feel like he's more, we see him as a brighter person than Edwina, who says that her fiance left her. So, you know, it can kind of flow either way on that meter. And I just think there's one of the most basic things to point out about this film and about Coen Brothers films in general is just nobody writes this good. Like, the writing is just so colorful and stylized in a way that is evocative of golden age Hollywood, when you might have had some more literate writers in the room, or maybe if you want to be more charitable, modern films are maybe tend to lean more on visual aspects. But in any case, there's a musicality and a pop to the dialogue that's so engaging and exciting, you know. And I think, you know, it was evident certainly in Blood Simple, but this one was like really caught your attention for sure.
Yeah, there's just more dialogue in this too. I think it's the first film where you really see their love of language come out, and you, as we kind of been talking about, it kind of lays the groundwork for a lot of future Coen's characters and Coen's films. It was funny. I looked up the Ebert Pan of Raising Arizona, and it opens with him talking about how he has a problem with movies where everybody talks as if they were reading out of an old novel about a bunch of would-be colorful characters. And then the first thing he cites is a good example where it works is a film called True Grit, which is unknowingly laying the groundwork for a future Coen's project. But yeah, I mean, I think what you're talking about, Scott, was like their influence for their dialogues, at least, is you know, Howard Hawks and Preston Sturges and you know, their screenwriters and people who just kind of love the flow of language and the, you know, rapid patter and, you know, this sort of flood of clever words that you kind of have to process as you're listening to it, because you have to keep up with the characters too. It's a really fun thing. But like that, you know, not I honestly buy, you know, the high-low discussion gets a little fuzzy, but like putting that next to, you know, High getting shot by a guy reading Jugs magazine is a really fun juxtaposition of different styles of comedy in one film, isn't it?
Yeah. And given, you know, how early this falls in the Coen's filmography, and given the presence of two actors who show up a lot in that filmography, John Goodman and Frances McDormand, it's interesting to have Nick Cage be sort of the opening salvo of this, like, loquacious Coen's, you know, because he never worked with them again, right?
No.
Yeah. Keith, like, as the expert, how do you feel about, how does Cage acquit himself in the world of the Coens?
I mean, I think it's a really good match. I think this is his, you know, first like really great comic performance. I love Peggy Sue Got Married, but that's just sort of a strange eccentric performance more than anything else. And I think this is one where he, you know, just looking at his filmography, he'd done good work before. Like, you know, Birdie was a really strong naturalistic performance, but this is kind of, oh, let's keep an eye on this guy kind of performance. I mean, mm-hmm. I think I wasn't alone in like kind of, you know, locking on to Cage after seeing this movie and like kind of keeping an eye out for what he was going to do in the future. And then I'm sure not the only one who eventually, well, I'm sure I know not the only one who eventually wrote a book, but I was trying to make a joke about that. But I'm not sure it was the happiest collaboration. You know, not to sidetrack too much, but like, you know, if you read about Cage at the time, it's kind of funny because it's like, you know, in the 80s, it's like, oh, he raised hell on this set. Oh, he was really difficult. Oh, he almost got fired. Moonstruck was apparently not a very happy shoot at all. But like when I talked to anyone from the early 90s on, like John Dahl, it was always like super professional, showed up, knew his lines. He was like, you know, the most predictably reliable person on in the cast. You know, it's, so at some point a switch flipped apparently, and the sort of like troublemaking or young actor kind of gave way to a different kind of actor. But
he did that. What did he do? Like the high kicks and stuff in that. What that talk show appearance? A notorious talk show appearance. When was that?
Oh yeah, that was a British talk show promoting Wild at Heart. Maybe around then is when things started to change. I'm not sure.
Into that,
but
yeah.
We're really getting deep into my book. But like, you know, if you watch that, it's like, is he really crazy or is he playing crazy? Is this good promotion for the film and Nicolas Cage as an eccentric actor? It's like, you know, maybe I can't necessarily tell. I have my suspicions. But apparently, like, this was not the happiest collaboration, as I said. Cage has a lot of ideas, and the Coens are, you know, famously precise. They have a definite ideas about what they want. Everything's storyboarded. Their dialogue's very precise. And it's not necessarily, I think they're, you know, my sense I get is they're really good at collaborating with actors, but it has to be the right kind of collaboration. And it might be a reason why some people come back to work with the Coens again and again, and some don't.
We should maybe give a shout out to Holly Hunter in this film, because I just, well, she's incredible in it. And the other thing is, like, I'm realizing that 87 would have been the same year as Broadcast News, right? I mean, did she really do these two films in one year? That's kind of amazing. Yeah,
it's really like a coming out year for her.
Yeah.
And, you know, Coens and Cage and I mean, Goodman, I think it's Goodman had been like True Stories, had been in a few other things too, but this is like his, you know, first like real, you know, John Goodman-y performance, I guess you could call it. It's really quite a turning point for a lot of people.
Yeah. Like, Holly Hunter is obviously great in this, and she gets so many choice lines, and Ed is sort of the instigator of this plot, but it's tricky because this is ultimately High's story, and she is sort of more in the role of, I don't want to quite reduce her to a narrative device, but, you know, her characterization is maybe not as strong as Hyde's, and she kind of, I think, exists maybe a little more symbolically in his story as sort of the impetus to go straight and break the cycle of recidivism and go after the unattainable American dream. It doesn't feel like as rich of a character even as Broadcast News does, you know. She's a great addition to this, but it doesn't feel like it's the movie is about her in the same way.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I mean, in that, I mean, she is an instigator of change here. Mm-hmm. She's Lady Macbeth.
Go ahead, say it.
Lady Macbeth. I was going to just say yeah. If we're going to connect it to go all the way forward to another Coen joint, solo Coen yeah. joint. Decades later, we could say she's sort of the Lady Macbeth here. I mean, she presses him to take this child when they're in the middle of doing it and he's unsuccessful at first try. She doesn't let him back in the car until he brings her that baby. And then, of course, once they have Nathan Jr., then it's her who's kind of trying to push him into doing things a certain way. It's tough in that respect. I think it's a very still a really funny performance, though, and it's one that kind
of it's a fun role. It just doesn't feel like maybe the most like rewarding role on a character level.
No, but I mean, it's so fun. Like the way she cries about when she says "I love him so much" and just starts weeping is so good. And
yeah.
It's a fun turn from her for sure. And comparing it to Broadcast News is kind of unfair to this film because that role and that performance is just so more full bodied. But I think she shows a incredible range here and fits right in with the Coen style, which is another thing. Do we see her again in a Coen film? I don't think we do, right? Is this her first and last as well?
She's in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, playing kind of a similar wife role to, I believe it's George Clooney's character.
That's a lot of people in that one.
Yeah, to George Clooney's character.
Mm. So no alienating behavior from Holly Hunter on that set or something.
she and McDormand were roommates, I believe. Frances McDormand were roommates. I think they kind of wanted her for Blood Simple at first, if I'm not mistaken. So it's like sort of an alternate universe where she's the star of Blood Simple and maybe Frances McDormand's the star of this one.
Yeah. You know, just to keep going down the cast, you know, shout out to Trey Wilson as Nathan Arizona Senior, who many of the great lines in this movie. The one that made me laugh the most this time was him being asked if Arizona was his real last name, and he said it's it wasn't. That would you buy furniture from unpainted Huff Heinz? I just thought that was really funny. And also, of course, describing the the pajamas having Yodas and shit on them is also a good line. But Trey Wilson was also kind of hot at the time because he had a plum role as the manager of the Durham Bulls in Bull Durham, right?
Yeah, he was on a real run there for a while. Gone too soon. He died at 40. But a bunch of good parts there toward the end. And I think he really opens like the door to like the really emotional mm-hmm. finale to this movie, which just gets me every time. It gets me harder as I get older and, you know, have a family of my own and, you know, staring down, you know, the future and what it all means. I mean, I love the end of this movie so much. I mean, I love Nathan Arizona's forgiveness of the people who you know, shucks, it's no big deal. You kidnapping Nathan Jr. since you brought him back. But when he talks about how he wouldn't know what he would do if his wife left him, you know, mm-hmm. and it connects to their own, this ultimately being about Ed and Hyde's marriage to some degree, and then, you know, opens the gateway to that amazing final scene.
I would say, I mean, he's kind of sort of a moral center to this film. I mean, I think he comes across at the beginning as this kind of, you know, huckster who even in the middle of this crisis is still wanting, you know, using the publicity to try to get people to still come out for good deals at Unpainted Arizona. But he does two things in the film. One, I think he sees Leonard Smalls for who he is and is able to kind of turn away that particular offer, I suppose. And then you get the scene that you referenced at the end there, Keith, where he is able to kind of understand that by bringing his son back, that he can kind of piece together what had happened and show a little grace, a little forgiveness. It is a lovely moment, and I think one that, you know, from a character I don't know that we don't necessarily expect that moment from him based on our first impressions, I guess.
Well, yeah, because he's like such an embodiment of this like unattainable Reagan era American dream, you know, with the sprawling suburban mansion and the more kids than they know what to do with, but also the obviously the means to support them all while High has to hold up a convenience store to get Huggies. You know, there's a certain, he's the embodiment of the economic disparity that makes the American dream unattainable for many people, including High and Ed, you know, and sort of the way that the idea of a nuclear family and having to have children to fully realize that American dream and the resources needed to support those children, like it's all very wrapped up in the character of Nathan Arizona. So to have him be the one to kind of absolve them at the end and encourage them to keep pursuing that dream is on one hand like very sweet and optimistic, but it could also be read, I think, is kind of cynical, you know, and sort of like the embodiment of something that the film kind of spends a lot of its energy undercutting. I don't know. Like, I agree, like, again, like on the surface, it's a really like sweet moment, but kind of in the grander design of this movie, I think I'm a little more, I remain more skeptical of Nathan Arizona while still being glad that he let them go. You know, he did give them the opportunity to keep chasing that dream that High ends the film on, you know, literally in his dreams. So ultimately a good guy, I guess, but also I don't like what he represents.
Yeah. He has the, a certain amount of what privilege to be as generous as he is there or something at the end, or he's being, yeah. I guess I can see where you're coming from on that. I mean, I think the film needs some kind of grace at that point, and it gets it, but maybe not, maybe he mm-hmm. wasn't the guy for it, but I do like that it has at least that kind of emotional component is present in the movie, because I think it can all seem just like a big cartoon, a very fun cartoon, but kind of it becomes a much thinner movie without having something like that present.
Yeah, I think the film also has to wind down at that point too, because otherwise it just keeps ramping up in energy, and it has to remind you that this is about a couple and a baby, and you know, their desire to hold on to something that's not really theirs is more than just, you know, chasing after a MacGuffin in a diaper. It actually is, you know, meaningful to the movie itself.
But as far as like grace notes, I agree with you, Keith, that like the film needs a denouement, and also just like kind of a resolution of the fact that they have this stolen baby, and you know. But I think like kind of for me anyway, the real like meaningful exchange is the one between. Have we really not talked about Leonard Smalls at all at this point?
No, we haven't.
Yeah. Like when High says, "I'm sorry," right when he pulls the pin on the grenade and kills him, and very unexpectedly to both of them. But, you know, I think if we are accepting that Leonard Smalls is, you know, embodiment of High's worst instincts, you know, worst criminal instincts, you know, and him killing that part of himself and being sorry for it, like that is a more to me effective like bittersweet note than this absolution offered by Nathan Arizona.
What do you make, I guess, though, of the pointed difference one of the pointed differences between Leonard Smalls and High is that High does not use a loaded gun. That, you know, Leonard Smalls is a violent mm-hmm. person, very violent. He's got grenades, he's got guns, he's terrorizing the countryside, and maybe he is High's worst image of himself. But High commits very petty armed robbery without ever, you know, putting any bullets in the gun, which I guess is maybe a technicality. It might get him. He gets off repeatedly at the parole board. Yeah. Well, okay then.
Yeah, I mean, it is just it's his darkest nature, or he literally thinks he kind of like dreamed him to life out of his subconscious. And when the first time Ed sees him, High's like, you can see him, like you know, like he doesn't believe that he's like real on this plane, because I think for High, he just so represents the evil that he fears is inside of him. And, you know, the mama didn't love me tattoo and the baby shoes dangling from it. Like, there's all these sort of implications, I guess, wrapped up in Leonard Smalls that, you know, the movie doesn't really resolve. But, like, I do think there's maybe an implied link there of, to whatever High's past may have been. Like, we don't know what his parental situation was. We don't hear anything about his mom. There's a lot of, like, absentee mothers in this film. Not even absentee, but sort of, like, less than ideal mothers populating this film. And I don't know. I think it all is, like, kind of meant to boil down into the essence of Leonard Smalls somehow. But within the film's, like, very brisk, madcap energy, it isn't, like, necessarily dwelling on it anymore. But I think it gives us just enough for that final, like, moment between the two of them, and that moment of recognition, realization from High when he says, "I'm sorry," to hit hard for me, at least.
Yeah, I mean, he's a tenderhearted character, for and how he got that way, we don't know. It almost feels like you don't get the feeling that his background was particularly easy. Maybe mama didn't love him. maybe that's another moment of recognition, really, when he sees that tattoo as well. Mm-hmm. But for whatever reason, there's goodness in him that hasn't been snuffed out by the world.
Yeah, well, and of course, we can't not mention the fact that they do share the tattoo. Keith, I see that you have that here on the list of questions. So
I do. It's waiting for someone to say it's a Woody Woodpecker tattoo, and I'll say it's not. It's Mr. Horsepower or off-brand Mr. Horsepower tattoo.
Oh yeah, you shouldn't have done that, Keith. You could have corrected us. It would have been a pleasure for you to do so.
It would have been a great moment.
It would have been great.
We've gotten so much positive feedback about that was a real hero moment there. when you made that observation,
our pedants out there would be very excited. Well, the other thing too about Leonard Smalls, I mean, it can be sort of. Now that the Coen brothers have made so many films, you can kind of see the origins of a lot of things in the second film. And, mm-hmm. Leonard Smalls is a character that proved that they could kind of have a character either manifest himself or herself or itself into something quite abstract. I mean, you think about, like, John Goodman again in Barton Fink, seeming at the beginning like one type of person and then becoming much more abstract and symbolic a character, as the film goes on, and also kind of a manifestation of Barton's thinking as well, because so much of Barton Fink is a movie that takes place inside of Barton's head, and who knows if this guy even exists, and so it kind of pairs up pretty well that way. I mean, we might be inclined if we were recording a podcast in the early 90s to pair Barton Fink with Raising Arizona and see some connections there.
We did Barton Fink. We paired Barton Fink with Hail Caesar, I think.
Yeah, which is great because they have the studio connection. Oh, that's good stuff.
Yeah.
Good films.
We're running out of movies, y'all.
I know. luckily, the Coens have created a lot of them, so we can continue to go to that well when we need to. But we have hit on some Coens, for sure. And why not? They've made so many juicy films. And they also make films that are very Next Picture Show friendly because they're so referential. They you can always kind of, mm-hmm. if you want to grab out a Sturges film or something like that, or a Hawks film, or Key Largo or whatever it is that comes up, then it's there for you because they actually provide that material for you. And we had tons of choices. This was not our only choice, certainly, with Drive Away Dolls. There were a lot of other influences, too.
Well, we might talk about some of the roads we did not travel with this pairing with the next episode when we talk about Drive Away Dolls. And we're not done with Raising Arizona. We'll be talking about it when we make connections with that episode as well. But for now, we're going to pause, have a brief break, and come back with feedback. Now it's time for feedback, but before we get to it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Campanar and Josh Larson. In one of their upcoming episodes, Adam, Josh, and Chicago film critic Michael Phillips will look at the Oscars. And in a subsequent episode, they'll talk about Dune Part 2. I look forward to both of those. As for feedback, we recently got a call from a kind of familiar voice of somebody named Bob. Let's give it a listen.
Hey, Next Picture Show, this is Bob. In your packed episode about the last detail, you didn't have time to discuss the scene where the shore patrollers confront the marine prison officer. This is a shame because I think this scene is both the climax of the movie and a strong parallel to the climax of The Holdovers. Bedusky and Mule are non-commissioned officers, which means they spend a lot of time teaching boys to be sailors. Mule is proud of telling his mom about the men who work for him, and Bedusky's great joy in life seems to be teaching Semaphore. But from the get-go, they're frustrated. They're on a break between terms, much like Giamatti is, and their charge is an ex-sailor who can't benefit from their training. So they spend the movie trying and failing to find something they can do for him. They finally find it when the Marine berates them for mistreating the prisoner, asking them if that's how things are done in the Navy, and then offers them the defense of Meadows having tried to escape, which he did. Mule and Bedusky don't take that defense, instead just taking the blame and insults to themselves and their service from the least welcome source. They don't really know if this sacrifice will do Meadows any good, and it seems even less likely that he'll ever know they did it, but it's the one thing they can do, so they do it. In true 70s fashion, this all happens without much fanfare, and Bedusky's characterization of the Marine as someone who doesn't even know to take the extra copies is less graphic than Giamatti's insult to the Dean after making his own sacrifice, but this makes me love it all the more. Looking forward to all your future discussions, Bob.
Love it. That's some great feedback from Bob, as usual. And yeah, we did mention it, and that is an excellent kind of connection between those two movies, and a subtle one. I don't know if it, you know, I mean, I guess it's right. It's kind of properly proportioned in a way that it does not hit you over the head at all. I mean, I guess you can say that happens at the end of The Holdovers, because, you know, he gets kind of the saltiest possible line to drop there on his way out the door. Giamatti does, but it is interesting to think about this gesture, to think about what it even means, and also how it relates to what they, you know, what their jobs generally are. So I think that's really good feedback from Bob.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought of Mule and Bedusky in a teaching role, even when we did that pairing. But I like that Bob points out the sort of instructional instinct they both seem to have toward this young cadet, combined with a impotence to really do anything real for him at this point, and that kind of translating to what they end up trying to do for him here. So a connection that we hadn't really even seen there. So thank you, Bob, for that.
Yeah,
it's a good one. I hadn't thought about that either. So thank you, Bob. Well, we always appreciate it when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations, especially when they're insightful like that. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or send us a voice memo or email us at comments@netpictureshow.net. And that's it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about Drive Away Dolls before looping back to pick up Raising Arizona again, like a container of diapers on the side of the road. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. You can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, hang on to your babies if you have any, and think twice about taking the babies of others. It inevitably turns into kind of a hassle.